Welcome to New Books in Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. In this episode, I talk with Kevin Avery about his book, Everything is an Afterthought, The Life and Writings of Paul Nelson, published in 2011 by Fantagraphics Books. Paul Nelson was writer for Rolling Stone magazine, an inventor of what is now commonly understood as rock criticism, and A&R man for Mercury Records, who discovered the New York Dolls. Nelson's writings, many of which are contained in the second part of this book, provide moving portraits not only of rock musicians as people with troubles like you and me. They also show Nelson as someone who is passionate about rock as an art form, as well as a man with a sincere belief that rock musicians can express feelings and ideas that are both personal and ubiquitous. They can represent the human condition in sublime fashion. Avery's book represents a collection of Nelson's writings about Jackson Browne, Leonard Cohen, Rod Stewart, Warren Zevon, and the New York Dolls, among others. Before the writings, however, Avery provides a detailed biography of Paul Nelson. From his upbringing in Warren, Minnesota, to the final days of his life in New York City, Avery shows Nelson as someone with a singular focus to be his own man, his own American hero. Though his first love was movies, Nelson's writings focused on music, with some divergence into film and literature. He, along with a friend, founded the Little Sandy Review, a folk music magazine, worked on the staffs of Sing Out and Rolling Stone, and published articles for Musician and The Village Voice, along with others. Nelson's story is a tragic one, not unlike the myths of the musical, celluloid, and literary heroes he so admired. He dropped out of the writing business in the 1980s to work at a video rental store. He lived the last decades of his life utterly alone, in poverty, and in the end, with Alzheimer's disease. Kevin Avery is also the author of Conversations with Clint, Paul Nelson's Lost Interviews with Clint Eastwood, 1979 to 1983. He lives in Brooklyn, New York, which is where I reached him for this interview. Hello, Kevin, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Hi, Matt. Thank you.
Thanks for being on our show. Your book is divided into two parts. Book one is the biography of Paul Nelson, and book two is a collection of his writings. But I thought we'll run our interview roughly like that. But first, please, Kevin, tell us a bit about your biography.
Sure. Well, I was actually born and raised in Salt Lake City, which is about 5 hours north of where you are, and lived there my entire life up until 2005. At the end of 2005. I moved back to Brooklyn, where I live now, to get married. And growing up, I had always wanted to write. I can remember writing as far back as when I was 4 years old. And I over the years, began writing short stories and submitting them to magazines. Had some luck with that, sold a few. In early, I guess it was around 1992, I met a gentleman who became a very good friend, and he was also the editor of a local magazine, and he invited me to start writing about music, and which really appealed to me because I was a very passionate fan of rock music, especially, and some of my favorite writers had been critics. So I started writing for them. I remember the first review I wrote was for a Neil Young concert in Park City, Utah. And over the years, probably from around 1992 through around 2000, I wrote a considerable amount of nonfiction about not only music, but popular culture. And, got a chance to review interview a lot of people whose music I admired. And I did that, like I say, till around 2000 or so, and then kind of got away from writing for a few years. And jump ahead to, end of 2005, when I moved back to Brooklyn to get married. And I made a list for myself as far as things I needed to do before I left and things I needed to do once I arrived in New York. And on that second list at the top, I had put reach out to Paul Nelson. And I wrote Paul Nelson a letter. It was as much a proposal as it was a fan letter, I guess, suggesting that we work together to anthologize some of his best works. I knew that Paul hadn't written in some time, and I knew that he, for the last 14 or 15 years, had been worked as a clerk in a video store, Evergreen Video, in the West Village. So that's where I sent the letter, and that was probably in February 2006, and I never heard back from Paul. In June, when I got married, a friend was visiting from out of town, from Florida, and I was with him in the city, showing him around Manhattan, and we ended up in the West Village. I remember it was raining like crazy that day, and I happened to look up, and we were in front of Evergreen Video. So I thought, you know, this was a great time to go in and introduce myself and see if Paul had indeed received my letter. And the young man behind the desk, college age kid, informed us that Paul hadn't worked there in about a year or so. So I left not really knowing whether or not my letter had ever found its way to Paul. A month or so later, in July, I received a phone call from a gentleman who introduced himself as Michael Seidenberg. And he said that he was a good friend of Paul Nelson's. And he informed me, he says, I don't know if you know or not, but Paul passed away a couple of weeks ago. And he told me that, for the last year of Paul's life, he had not been in very good health, both mentally and physically. And the reason for his call is, he says, I wanted to let you know that Paul indeed did receive your letter. And he was very touched by it. He was very touched that somebody remembered his work. And it was something that he really wanted to do. He kept saying, I really want to do this when I get, feeling better. And, unfortunately, he just never got feeling better. And that was the day I began writing everything as an afterthought. Working on it and researching it, and which I would do over the next 4 years or so.
And weren't you in doing the research? Weren't you invited into his apartment by someone?
Yeah. What had happened was, one of the first people that I needed to get in touch with was Paul's son, a gentleman named Mark Nelson, a lawyer who lived in Dallas, Texas. And Michael Seidenberg put me in touch with him. And, he explained that Paul and Mark had not really seen each other very many times in their life, that Paul had left Mark and his mother when Mark was very young, and that they'd only seen each other a handful of times since then. But I felt it was very important to reach out to Mark and introduce myself and tell him what it was I wanted to do, which at that point really was just, to collect all, in my mind, I would collect all of Paul Nelson's work. I at that point, it was a kind of a naive thought because I really wasn't aware of how much Paul had written. And so I reached out to Mark, and we seemed to hit it off, and he gave me his blessing to go ahead with this project. And in January of 2007, Paul died probably toward the end of June or the first of July of 2006. His body wasn't found for about a week, so it's not quite certain, which the exact day that he died, but his body was found on the 4th of July. From that time until January or so, the apartment had been sealed because nobody had been able to identify Paul's body because of the condition that the body was in, because it was very hot summer, time of summer. Mm-hmm. When he died, the police, wouldn't let Michael Seidenberg come up and identify the body. Because of that, the apartment had remained sealed by the medical examiner while they conducted DNA tests. So in January of 2007, when Mark flew to New York to collect his dad's belongings, he he actually he called me that first night and said, you probably want to come over here. I have something I want to show you. And so I indeed went into the city, and what he wanted to show me was that there was at least, I should explain, in Paul's last year especially, he had terrible trouble with his short-term memory, and he used to write notes to himself. His apartment was just filled with notes, and they would be ranging from anything from his favorite tracks on a particular Bob Dylan album to what he needed to buy, what kind of cough drops were his favorite, and where was the best place to get them. But among all of these notes posted in various spots around the apartment were notes to himself to get in touch with me, to, you know, arrange to have lunch or dinner with me at his favorite restaurant, and you know, other places. He just had my name and my address and my phone number tacked up, and you know, the old note saying call the book guy. And I'd already at that point been working on the project for 5 or 6 months, but you know, that really compelled me to move forward and finish this project, because you know, I at that point knew there was no doubt that this was something that he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into his life then. Tell us a bit about Paul's early life in Minnesota.
He was born in Warren, Minnesota, which is just right up in the very northwestern corner of Minnesota, on January 21st, 1936. And he had his parents gave him a very, very religious upbringing, especially his mother. Paul himself was never really that religious, and so you know that certainly caused some friction, you know, during his formative years. His parents were, if I remember correctly, they were first generation Norwegian or you know Swedish immigrant parents. And they belong to the Evangelical Mission Covenant Church. And among the things that this church did not believe in and condone, you know, was music and dancing and movies. You know, Paul, you know, never saw his first movie until he was, you know, probably close to a teenager. And at one point, when he was in high school or so, he came home from school one day to find that his mother had burned all of his comic books, and as well as, I believe, his copy of The Naked and the Dead. And so, you know, needless to say, there's a little bit of friction between him and his parents, but probably, you know, nothing unlike most teenage kids. As they grow up and adopt their own taste. But Paul, you know, gravitated to writing very early on. And, you know, he read, you know, he boasted that he read every book in the Warren Library probably 3 or 4 times. The library was pretty small. And, you know, the town itself was small. It was only about 1,500 people. And you know, Paul lived there until he went to the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, and you know, it was in there. You know, was there for several years, and that was where he, you know, met a gentleman named Bobby Zimmerman, and Bobby Zimmerman, of course, would go on to become Bob Dylan.
And their stories are actually kind of parallel, don't they?
They do. You know, Dylan grew up in Hibbing, Minnesota, and he ended up going to the University of Minnesota as well. And from there, he moved on to New York City. And, you know, Paul wasn't really very far behind him. Paul ended up marrying his high school sweetheart, Doris. And, you know, they ended up moving to New York City in, I believe it was around 1963. And Paul moved there to accept a position as managing editor of Sing Out magazine. And at that time, Sing Out was, you know, the preeminent folk music magazine. Needless to say, over the years, his and Bob Dylan's path, crossed, many times. And probably, no more significantly than at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965, when Dylan plugged in and went electric. And Paul Nelson famously became one of the few folk music critics who championed Dylan going electric. And he felt so strongly about that the article he wrote about it also doubled as his resignation letter from Sing Out. He knew that that there was going to be a backlash of the traditional folksters, not agreeing with Dylan's decision, and Paul didn't really want to be part of that. He always boasted that when Dylan went electric, so did he, and he was interested in at the time they called it the new music, and that new music is what we came to know as rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. If you could back up just a few years to the Little Sandy Review and tell us something about that.
Yeah, in the late 50s, 59, 1960, Paul and his college best friend at college, a gentleman named John Pancake, they got it. They both loved to write. They both loved to talk about music and talk about movies. And they actually flipped a coin. They decided they wanted to start a little magazine of their own. And they flipped a coin to see whether it was going to be about music or about movies. And music won. And so they founded the Little Sandy Review, which they co-wrote for a few years. And it was a totally homegrown thing. That they were put together on a mimeograph machine and put it all together themselves. And, it actually became a very, very significant, publication. And it was just a very, very small, elegant little, simple publication. But over the years, it was amazing how many people Paul would run into who, subscribed to that magazine. And, They really focused on traditional serious folk music. They really didn't like how folk music was being diluted and popularized. And in the course of this, probably one of their most significant readers was Bob Dylan. At one time, Bob came over and even approached them about perhaps promoting him or managing him in some way. And one of the famous stories, and Paul tells this story in the documentary No Direction Home, the Martin Scorsese film about Bob Dylan. Paul appears there and tells the story about how one weekend when Paul and John Pancake were away for the weekend, Dylan came over and helped himself to about 25 of their rare folk records. And those records, were very significant in Dylan's career in terms of he was absorbing all of this folk music, Ramblin' Jack Elliott and all of this other music that he'd never heard before. And that was something that the way the story goes, John Pancake really never forgave Dylan for doing that. But of course, Paul did. And as I said, their paths crossed again several times through the years.
think Dylan writes about that too, doesn't he? In Chronicles, he might mention the
in Bob story. Dylan's Chronicles, Volume One. He writes about it there, and although Dylan, always the chameleon, he doesn't even mention Paul Nelson in Chronicles. Though, of course, when he introduces Nelson in No Direction Home, and where he's very much part of the story, but he doesn't mention John Pancake. So, there's always been kind of a debate on whose records, did Dylan actually steal? Were they Paul's or were they John's? And John always said they were Paul's. Paul always said they were John's. And when I talked to John Pancake, he says, "Well, I really don't." He says, "We both had the same records." So he said, "It doesn't matter how you tell the story." So,
So after Newport, Paul transitions from a writer of folk music to a writer of rock. Right?
Yeah. And I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
Oh yeah, he certainly learned what he knew or used what he had learned about folk music in his rock writing, because he very much saw where this music had all come from. I mean, down through the years, even when he was trying to sign the New York Dolls to Mercury Records, he realized that music came out of a great tradition of folk music, and especially the lyrical content of that music. And Paul, literally is one of the guys who invented the form of rock music criticism. He was there when the music started, and he was discovering it. And, that was one thing about Paul at his best, is when he was excited about, an artist and maybe even a new type of music. You could just feel that enthusiasm and that excitement in his writing. And, it's the same as whether he was writing about Dylan going electric or whether he was writing about Never Mind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols. You got the sense that, he had discovered something exciting and something very meaningful to him, and he wanted to share it with you, the reader.
When does he start working at Rolling Stone?
The first time was actually in 1969. He was a freelancer at that time, and he had penned a piece or two for Rolling Stone, and Jan Wenner, the publisher of Rolling Stone, actually put a little item in the magazine introducing Paul as kind of their East Coast representative. This is when the magazine was still based out in San Francisco. And for a matter of months, Paul held that position. It wouldn't be until 1978 that he actually returned to the magazine to be on staff, although in the years in between, he certainly freelanced for them considerably. But in 1970, he was actually invited to work at Mercury Records in their publicity department. And Paul accepted that post. And so from 1970 to 1975, Paul worked first in publicity and then very quickly segued into A&R. And there were years that, Paul called the best years of his life and the worst years of his life.
And so while at Mercury, since you transitioned to their force, he courts the New York Dolls.
He courts the New York Dolls. His good friend and fellow critic and a gentleman who he got a job at Mercury Records, Bud Scapa, happened to see the New York Dolls playing one night at I believe at the Mercer Arts Center, and he and Paul went to see this band play, and Bud actually, he wasn't overly impressed at that time, I should say, but Paul thought they were magnificent. And Paul, between the time he first discovered the Dolls and the time he actually signed them to Mercury, he estimates that he probably saw them play about 200 concerts. And they were just, he fell in love with them. They were not like anything he'd ever seen before. Like I mentioned before, they had this great tradition of songwriting that they drew from. And they, you know, their music was exciting. And it took him a couple of, it took him at least a year to convince his hires up at Mercury that this is a band that they really needed to sign. And when they did finally agree, you know, unfortunately, they only released two albums while they were on Mercury, and the band ends up disintegrating. And it was very difficult for Paul, because he really believed in the band, and he wanted to see them succeed commercially. And you know, in his lifetime, they certainly never did. And you know, it was kind of ironic that the band still exists today, at least in the form of David Johansen and Sylvain Sylvain. And, shortly after Paul died in 2006, the band reformed and put out another album.
They almost seem kind of an anomaly, don't they? I mean, he's writing about, he really likes Jackson Browne, Warren Zevon, Leonard Cohen, these singer-songwriter types. And then he falls for the New York Dolls, and even punk rock generally, he kind of falls for, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, he loved the Ramones. You know, he thought that, you know, the Ramones made him laugh, and you know, he found their music exciting. The one thing that all of these artists have, when you talk about, you know, especially, you know, Leonard Cohen and Jackson Browne, two of Paul's favorites, is they have just a great tradition of lyrics that they offer. And, you know, Paul, if anything, Paul was a lyric guy. He really, you know, he could connect to songs that told a story, or songs that, you know, evoked a feeling. And, you know, that was, you know, one thing that, attracted him to the New York Dolls. He, at the heart of it, you know, that I think Robert Christgau said that to me. He says that was Paul's genius, that, you know, amidst all this noise and everything, at the heart of the New York Dolls, he could see, you know, David Johansen's great lyrics. And it made sense. He was always drawn to these people who he could identify with, I guess, is one way of putting it. If he really loved a piece of work, you know, let's say Jackson Browne, he wanted to know as much about that piece of work as possible. And, you know, which is why, in many cases, you know, Paul developed friendships with these people, because, you know, what better way to learn more about a person's work and understand a person's work than, you know, to get to know the person themselves.
I believe there is a bit of a debate about whether a critic should befriend the people they're writing with, right?
And absolutely.
Paul think about that much?
Paul, I don't know that Paul really ever gave it a second thought. It certainly, did concern some of his fellow critics. Because, you know, that's one of the first things you learn in journalism is, you know, don't get too close to the subject you're writing about. And, by the same token though, Paul never would have been able to write some of his best articles if he didn't have, this relationship that he'd forged. And, the best example that leaps to mind is Paul's, 1981 Rolling Stone cover story about Warren Zevon's battle with alcoholism, mm-hmm. where, Paul reveals, you know, not only that he and Zevon have been, you know, very good friends for the last few years, but he even participated in Zevon's intervention, when he went into rehab. And, if Paul hadn't gotten that close to Zevon, that piece would never exist. Similar articles that he wrote about Jackson Browne. The downside of it is what happens when, this artist, who is your friend, releases an album that maybe you don't like. And, you know, Paul found him in that situation when Bruce Springsteen, who, you know, he had a relationship, when Bruce Springsteen released Nebraska, I believe in 1982, Paul just did not know what to make of the album. And he wasn't sure how he was going to write about it. And that particular piece is included in the book. And it's very interesting how Paul ultimately does end up writing about it. And he, kind of reaches back to his days of writing about folk music at that Sing Out and the Little Sandy Review. And you know, that's how he learns to understand and appreciate Nebraska. Mm-hmm.
So he leaves Mercury Records and he goes back to Rolling Stone, right?
Well, what he does
is... that the order?
Well, yeah. He left Mercury Records in 75. The Dolls had broken up. They were no longer on Mercury. And Paul left Mercury. And depending on who you talk to, he was either fired or he left of his own accord. And he started freelancing again. And fairly quickly got a job as record reviews editor at Circus magazine. And he was there for a couple of years, and that was when the invitation to come and be record reviews editor at Rolling Stone came. And so from 1978 through 1982, he was record reviews editor at Rolling Stone, and that was probably his most prolific period as a critic. Mm-hmm.
Was he comfortable being a rock critic, or did he think he could be better?
Oh, I don't think he certainly didn't see anything wrong with being a rock critic. In his heart, he always wanted to be a movie critic. As much as he loved music, movies were his first love, and he just said that at the point when he came to New York in the early '60s, it was easier to get a job as a music critic than it was a movie critic. But on the other hand, you know, over the years, he wrote a handful of just really stunning reviews of films that, like Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry and Sam Peckinpah's The Getaway. And they're just very interesting articles and, you know, very vibrant. And they really hint at, you know, what he could have been as a music critic. He certainly didn't see anything wrong with being a music critic. I think he felt like he was serving as a very valuable conduit, you know, between the music and the potential fans that were out there. And if anything, what discouraged him most about being a critic was, when artists he would admire, like the Sex Pistols or say the Clash, ultimately did not succeed commercially at the time, you know, or did not stay together. And what ended up happening with Paul is the music changed and it went in a direction that he really didn't care for very much. In the 80s when what was rock, what was punk rock and new wave became very plastic, and that's when he really lost interest.
And what does he do then when he loses interest? Where does he go from there?
Well, when he left Rolling Stone, he ran into Kurt Loder in the hallways of Rolling Stone, and Kurt asked him what he was going to do, and Paul said he wanted to go find a job where he didn't have to think for a while. And the last year or so at Rolling Stone had been very intense for him. There had been many battles with publisher Jan Wenner. Jan Wenner wanted the record reviews to get shorter. Paul could give several thousand words to a particular article, and he was very protective of the record reviews section, and on the other hand, here was the publisher, Jan Wenner, who wanted these reviews to be, you know, he got it down to a formula. You know, they could be no more than, you know, 32 or 33 lines long. And, they could not, reference other people's works in a derogatory way. I mean, it was, he had a complete formula that he had issued, in a memo. And, he wanted the reviews to, have stars, one star through four or five stars. And Paul just, he couldn't abide by that. And so he resigned. And he did exactly what he said. He initially, his goal was to, write some books. He got a contract to write a biography of Neil Young. He was going to write Jackson Browne's biography. He wanted to write a book about detective novelist Ross McDonald. And unfortunately, none of those things ever came to be. Around the same time, Paul's mom died, and he had something of an emotional breakdown, and he ended up for a few years being copy editor at a publication called The Jewish Week, and did not write about music again, I believe, until 1990 or 91. And at that point was invited to write some reviews and some articles for Musician Magazine, which he did for the next year and a half or 2 years. And again, it just, the music that interested him was very few and far between. And he never really wrote about music again, I think, until 1997 or so, when a couple little tiny capsule reviews of his appeared in People magazine. And it just, again, the music wasn't the kind of music that interested him. So, and he wasn't about to, try to reacquaint himself with what rock music had become. And so whatever writing he did from that point on really was just for himself. Mm.
He seemed enamored with the idea of both in movies and rock, I suppose, of the great American hero like Clint Eastwood, many of the characters he played in Bruce Springsteen. Where does that come from?
It comes from the tradition of.
And he seemed like he got disappointed, as you said, sometimes when his rock heroes turned out not to be heroes.
Yeah. Well. In terms of the image of the hero, certainly comes out of the tradition of John Ford westerns, Howard Hawks film noir and westerns as well, as the hard boiled detective fiction that Paul just loved. In terms of would he sometimes get fall in love too much with his subjects, probably. And, that was probably too why he wasn't able to write about some of them. You know, he said that sometimes what he wanted to say was so big that he just couldn't find the words. And as the music changed, some of the artists that he had championed, their music changed as well. And sometimes, weren't up in Paul's opinion to, their earlier work. In case of somebody like Dylan, some of Paul's most glowing reviews that he ever wrote, and some of the best pieces he ever wrote, were about Dylan's music. By the same token, some of the most damning reviews he ever wrote were about Bob Dylan's music as well. And so he knew that came with the territory. I can't remember somebody that I interviewed for the book, made the comment, Paul just didn't realize that everything ultimately disappoints. I'm not sure that that's true or that Paul necessarily believed in that, but, he certainly did have his artists that he admired, and, even you know, till the end, you know, guys, especially like Leonard Cohen and Dylan, you know, he certainly continued to admire their work.
I think you include, I believe it's a one sentence review of Dylan at Budokan. And there's
yeah, I'm paraphrasing here, but I think the entire review consisted of what besides God has happened to this man.
That's one of the best ones in there.
Yeah.
How about now I'm just going to kind of pick and choose from because there's a lot of Paul's articles in the book, writings in the book. But
can I say something before?
Yes, please.
We talked about the fact that the book is broken up into two parts. The book one is basically Paul's biography. Book two is indeed, as you said, a collection of Paul's best writings. But more than that, the way the book was structured was there are many points and questions that are raised in Paul's biography that are answered in book two in Paul's own writing. The one thing that as a young reader, when I first started reading Paul, that I was certainly aware of was he was writing from a very personal standpoint, not necessarily autobiographical, because he never would really, very seldom, you know, cross that line. He always got the feeling that if, you know, he was involved in something he was writing, it was kind of not necessarily something that he wanted to do of his own will. He was just sort of a participant. But he always got the sense of Paul between the lines. And indeed, the more I learned about his own life, the more I discovered in his own writing that he was indeed writing very autobiographically. He even admits that to Leonard Cohen at one point when he says, you know, when I was writing about your music, I was really writing about myself. And so that was the opportunity that I saw with the second part of the book, was to not only present some of Paul's best writing, but at that point to kind of let Paul start telling the rest of his story and answer some of the questions that had been risen, you know, that had been raised in book one.
And in fact, there was a line that Paul writes that struck me about what you're talking about it's an article about Neil Young called Young's One Stop World Tour. And he writes that, you know, he likes the idea that Neil Young seems totally alone on stage. You know, as you write toward the end of Paul's life, he's totally alone.
Yeah. As the years went on, his taste in music grew smaller. It's almost like thinking of an aperture getting smaller and smaller and smaller. His taste got smaller, and the people in his life, the number of people in his life got smaller as well. And he did seem to sort of, recede from them, and, to the point where he wanted to turn their calls. And so by the end of his life, here's a guy who in the mid late 70s, you know, is literally at the center of the rock and roll scene, working at Rolling Stone and interviewing these stars, and he's friends with them and everything. And by the end of his life, you know, he's dead a week before anybody even finds his body.
And he saw this, at least in this article in Neil Young. He must have been seeing himself, I think, it almost sounds like.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah. How about his piece in the Rolling Stone Illustrated History of Rock about Dylan that gets eliminated from the second edition?
Yeah. He had been asked to write four pieces for that book, and anybody who's got that book remembers it. It's this terrific, oversized book that has a big red cover, and it's a wonderful book. And Paul's piece on Bob Dylan, first of all, he didn't turn it in on time, which was not uncommon for Paul. Paul, you know, throughout his career, battled with writer's block, and deadlines were very difficult for him to meet. But when he finally did deliver the piece, it certainly wasn't what the editor had expected. What Paul had done was he had not only written about Dylan and his career to that point, but he had done it and structured it kind of like a mini detective novel. Mm-hmm. And it was like an homage to, you know, his favorite detective writers like Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald and Dashiell Hammett. And it is just truly a wonderful piece. And unfortunately, the editor of that particular book didn't agree. You know, he thought it kind of clashed with everything else in that book, which was pretty straight rock journalism. And so when the second edition came around, that piece was missing.
Mm-hmm. You write that affected Paul. He was a bit disappointed about that, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, I don't know if he speaks of that particularly or not. I don't recall that.
Maybe it's this ongoing battle he's having with Jan Wenner and what the criticism should look like. And
that definitely, that definitely happened.
I have written here, Paul likes records, and I have this in quotes, about things that matter, even if the record isn't musically perfect. This is under an Elliot Murphy review. So what are things that matter for Paul, and what does he mean by that?
He's talking about friendship. He's talking about, doing the right thing. You know, I think something resonated for Paul certainly was, you know, you go back to The Big Sleep and, Humphrey Bogart saying, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, you know, if your partner's been killed, you're supposed to do something. And Paul's talking about, here's the thing with Paul, and it says so much about why he ended up the way he did. Paul had three great loves, music, books, and movies. And when you think about them, ultimately, they're things that you end up enjoying by yourself. And by the end of his life, you know, unfortunately, those things had taken the place of people. For Paul, the things that mattered were, you know, people who could express themselves in art and write about things that would, you know, move people, inspire people. And so I think that's what he was talking about.
You write that his Patti Smith piece in here is Paul at his best. You write that, even though he doesn't seem to like Patti Smith's music too much.
Yeah.
Talk about that piece a little bit.
Well, I think it's, you know, in terms of, at the time, it was certainly a brave piece because, you know, critics were falling all over each other to admire Patti Smith and her debut album, Horses. And Paul just couldn't figure her out in terms of, not figure her out per se, but figure out why she was deemed as successful as she had been artistically. He knew Patti, marginally. They used to run into each other at various used bookstores around the city. I'll tell you one thing that really mattered to Paul was he liked sincerity. He liked honesty. And I don't think he found Patti to be the most sincere person. He didn't like people who, pretended to be something that they were not. And I think there was a lack of authenticity in her work that just rubbed him the wrong way. And, what I meant about Paul at his best is even if you disagree with him, because I like Horses. I think it's a great album. And at the same time, I can read what he's written there, and he puts forth a great argument. I don't always agree with him, but I think he puts forward a great argument there. And, you know, when, Paul at his best was just his writing. It didn't matter what he was writing about. He made, you could tell it was important to him, and it was important to him that you understand, you know, why it was important to him.
Mm-hmm.
So
let's see. Let's skip to Leonard Cohen. We've already brought him up, but you write that he identifies more closely with Cohen maybe than any other artist he covers, and he writes an important interview with Leonard Cohen that becomes very personal, as you say.
Cohen's song certainly struck a chord with Paul. Paul, if anything, was a romantic, you know, in every sense of the word. And, you know, Leonard Cohen's songs about, romance has gone bad and aspiring for, you know, perfect love, they certainly struck a chord with Paul. And, you know, he encountered Cohen a few times through the years, but in 1991, Paul was actually given the opportunity to fly from New York to L.A. and interview Leonard Cohen for the L.A. Weekly. And he does, and he ends up spending, I believe, 4 or 5 days at Leonard Cohen's house in California interviewing him. And they're fascinating interviews. I've had the opportunity to listen to them. And, one of the things that they have in common is Cohen is several years older than most of the rock guys that Paul usually interviews. And because Paul himself was older, he was generally like 10 years older than most of the people he worked with over the years. And he and Cohen just really hit it off. And Cohen, who, has certainly had his troubles with depression and has had, breakdowns, became something of a sympathetic ear for Paul. And so their talks sometimes are very, very personal. And, Paul is very excited about the material that he's gotten. And unfortunately, Paul returns to New York and is never able to write about this, this particular interview.
Mm-hmm. Maybe my favorite piece is towards the end of the book, where he's been asked to write something for the history of Mercury Records.
Yes.
And he basically ends up interviewing himself.
Yes.
And it's one of the funnier pieces. I mean, Paul's never seems really funny until this part. It's almost like a Lester Bangs kind of writing.
Yeah, Paul. Paul could be very, very funny. He was very laconic, and he had a very dry sense of humor. And sometimes when it comes across in his pieces, it surprises you. This particular piece uses a device that he actually used a few other times in his career, where when he has mixed feelings about something, and he basically interviews himself. And in the case of what we're talking about here, it's on one hand, it's the artistic Paul interviewing the more rational, down to earth Paul. Like you say, some of it is very, very funny, and it covers his 5 years at Mercury, and it really focuses a lot on what he went through when he was trying to sign the New York Dolls to the label. And toward the end, it's he makes it very clear too how heartbreaking it was for him when the Dolls weren't a success, and when the band split up, and to the point that it hurt too much to listen to their music after all that happened.
Mm-hmm. To end up, there's a couple of interesting lines here. Towards the end, you write that, or maybe it's a quote from him where he says he lives his life like a work of art, and that he's in that work of art. And you also write about how he's writing a never-ending screenplay.
Yeah. The first quote, I think, if I remember correctly, is, and I don't remember the film, but it's a Robert Mitchum film. And when Paul heard that line, he identified with it immediately. That yes, I'm living my life like a work of art. And the screenplay you're talking about, Paul's friends were aware that he was writing a screenplay. This is after he actually, there were other screenplays that he started writing, you know, in the 70s that he never finished. But his friends in the 90s, you know, he told them that he was working on a screenplay when he would go home from work at the video store at night. And he really enjoyed it. And initially, you know, people thought, well, this is great. Paul's writing a screenplay. Paul loves movies. This makes perfect sense. You know, Paul knows Martin Scorsese. You know, maybe this is something that will happen. But as the years went on, you know, there was still this talk about this ongoing screenplay. And, you know, some people were told that it was like a Western. Other people thought it was a war story. Other people thought it was more modern. Well, it turns out that it was really all of those things. It was one screenplay that he just kept writing over and over and over. And literally in his apartment after he died, there were thousands of pages of this screenplay. And for Paul, I think it was not only just escaping into the world that he had created in this screenplay, I think it was he finally was enjoying writing simply for himself. There were no deadlines. There was no editor. There was nobody, you know, cutting his lines. It was simply finally he could enjoy the process of writing.
Mm-hmm. I'm always surprised when I get to the end of my hour, Kevin, and there's so much we didn't talk about. We didn't talk about much about Springsteen. We didn't talk much about Jackson Browne or Rod Stewart or Ross McDonald or Clint Eastwood. But I'll admit that I was a bit ignorant of Paul Nelson's writing, and I know a lot more about it now. And thank you for being on our show.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a conversation with Kevin Avery about his book, Everything is an Afterthought, The Life and Writings of Paul Nelson, published by Fantagraphics Books in 2011. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.